You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Firefighters Local 42 and Pipefitters Local 533. The Greater Kansas City Firefighters, IAFF Local 42 of Kansas City, Missouri, and part of the International Association of Firefighters, represents fire, EMS, and public safety professionals serving you since 1918. Local 42 advocates continuously for the public good, and we depend on you to help us defend the rights of our diverse membership of men and women. The Pipefitter powers the engines of industry that keep business thriving in America. They install, maintain, and service any system that involves air conditioning, heating, chemicals, or refrigeration in residential, commercial, or industrial buildings, as well as high-tech clean rooms. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we'll talk to Thomas Colchin about his new book, Shaping the Future of Work. We'll ask him what became of the post-war social contract and is there a new one on the horizon? Then, the Missouri Public Defenders are in crisis. They say they can't handle the nearly 90,000 cases a year for the working or unemployed who can't afford a lawyer. Do public defenders need a bailout? In the news, oh my God, there's sexual harassment in Congress? And drop that Oreo. Our feature at the end of the show, Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. Now for the news.
Sixteen Senate Democrats are asking the Trump administration to push for stricter labor standards in a renegotiated NAFTA agreement, asking that no elements of the New Deal be implemented unless and until all three North American countries have made adequate reforms to the labor market. In a letter sent yesterday to U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, the lawmakers asked that U.S. negotiators tighten the so-called May 10 labor agreement, which they blasted as inadequate in its current form. Specifically, they demanded that U.S. negotiators eliminate stipulations that say that labor law violations must be recurring and done in a manner affecting trade in order to constitute a violation. They also recommended building an independent labor monitoring and compliance body into NAFTA, which they argued would help overcome decades of inadequate monitoring and enforcement and help all workers. Quote, "We believe that the reforms outlined can reverse the race to the bottom that has led to job losses and wage stagnation in the United States," they wrote. USTR should engage face-to-face with lawmakers to distribute labor and other NAFTA ideas further, they asked, adding that doing so could spur creativity and bridge divides. Among the senators who signed included Wisconsin's Tammy Baldwin, Massachusetts's Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren, New York's Kristen Gillibrand, Connecticut's Chris Murphy and Richard Blumenthal, Hawaii's Mazie Hirono, Michigan's Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters, Rhode Island's Sheldon Whitehouse, Minnesota's Al Franken, Pennsylvania's Bob Casey, Oregon's Jeff Merkley, Illinois' Tammy Duckworth, and New Jersey's Bob Menendez and Cory Booker. So we ask, where's Missouri's Claire McCaskill?
When all the allegations about sexual harassment in Hollywood began coming out, it was only a matter of time before we'd begin to hear similar stories from the halls of government. The New York Times reports that a senior Senate staff member is accused of trying to tug open a junior aide's wrap dress at a bar. She said he asked why she was holding out. A former congressional aide says a congressman grabbed her backside and then winked as he walked away. A district worker said a House member told her to twirl in a dress for him and then gave her a bonus when he liked what he saw. 1,500 former Capitol Hill aides have signed an open letter to House and Senate leaders demanding that Congress do mandatory harassment training and revamp the Office of Compliance, which is the legislative branch's opaque in-house adjudicator. So if you work in Congress, what's the procedure to report harassment? Get this. Under federal law, complainants must undergo a confidential process where coworkers who might be able to provide corroborating evidence are excluded. They often must wait about 3 months before submitting an official complaint, yet must file one no later than 180 days after the episode took place. Once filed, victims must submit to up to 30 days of mandatory counseling and complete another 30 days of mediation. If mediation fails, the person then must wait 30 more days before seeking an administrative hearing or filing a lawsuit in federal district court. The system is so stacked, said Deborah Katz, a Washington lawyer who often works on sexual harassment cases. They just don't want people to come forward.
Alert! If you are currently eating an Oreo or thinking about it, stop. If it's a double stuff, cough it up. Check the label, and if it's made in Mexico, return package to the store. Today is a national day of action against Nabisco, maker of Oreos, Ritz crackers, and Chips Ahoy. All those products may be made in Mexico, where Nabisco's parent, Mondelez, has been moving hundreds of decent-paying union jobs and swapping them for jobs that are definitely not ritzy. In fact, the wages are less than a dollar an hour, with no benefits, so workers could only dream of buying a package of Oreos. The campaign, called hashtag check the label, it is organized by the BCTGM Union and Interfaith Worker Justice. There were protests against Nabisco today by union members and activists at 100-plus big box stores. There are no protests in Kansas City, but you can also spread the word on social media using the hashtag #CheckTheLabel to let your peers know about this movement.
Working at Russell Stover Candies isn't sweet, say members of SEIU Local 1, the janitors' union. On November 8th, Local 1 members in Kansas City rallied outside Russell Stover's headquarters at Volker and Oak Streets to demand justice for janitors. Stover's janitorial service is contracted out to PS Building Services. There are janitors who work hard to clean the building, but don't have a union or a voice on a job. So when Wesley Macon decided to do something about it, he spoke to his fellow workers about getting a union, and 2 days later, he was fired from his job. Of course, the union is filing charges for Wesley with the National Labor Relations Board, but while he waits, he's out of a job. Macon said, "Working people shouldn't have to fear for their jobs. The union is asking people to call Russell Stover and tell them the same, and that they need to tell their janitorial contractor, PS Building Services, to reinstate Wesley. You can call 1-800-777-4004. The news tonight was read by Jake White, Judy Ansel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum on KKFI 90.1 FM radio, community radio. My name is Lon Swearingen, and our guest is Tom Cutchin, co-author for for a book with Lee Dyer, Shaping the Future of the World, a handbook for action and news and a new social contract. Thomas Gutchen is a longtime professor at MIT Sloan School of Management and the co-director of the school's Institute for the Work and Employment Research, plus many awards and writer of many books. But Tom, would you define what a social contract is, and then what kind of social contract was developed during the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration?
Sure. Well, thank you, Lon, for the invitation to join your community in discussing the future of work. It's so important today. We use the idea of a social contract in a very simple way. What we mean by that term is basically what people expect work to achieve and what their obligations are, what businesses' obligation, what employees' obligation, what government's obligation is for producing positive results for everybody in their employment relationship. So it's the expectations and the obligations that we have for our jobs and for our employment settings. Now, we had a social contract once that worked pretty well from, as you said, the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt up to about 1980. And that social contract was built on a solid foundation of the labor legislation of the 1930s of the New Deal, Social Security, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, minimum wages, and most important, the right to join a union and engage in collective bargaining. And having those in place helped the economy to grow through and after World War II. And as the economy got better and productivity increased, so too did wages, because unions were strong enough to negotiate a fair share of the gains from economic growth for the workforce. And that created a sense of a viable social contract where firms were prosperous and employees shared in that prosperity.
What groups need to be involved in building a new social contract?
Well, it's very clear that business can't do it alone. Employees can't do it alone. We need to have the business community. We need to have the workforce involved and their representatives. We need to have a new labor movement involvement in decision-making. And then finally, government and educators have to also participate. Today, we need to have lifelong learning, and we need to have on-the-job training that goes throughout one's career. And so education has a more important role today than ever before. Business has to compete on the basis of treating employees as assets and investing in education and training and giving them the opportunities to contribute to the success of the business. Labor has to work in partnership with employers to enhance the workplace and to listen to what workers' needs are today. And then government has to set some fair rules of the game so that the environment allows people to share in the gains of the economy as it improves.
How can you bring these groups together? How would that work?
Well, we got terrible divisions in society today, and that's part of our problem. We don't talk to each other. Business doesn't talk to labor. Business doesn't talk to government. Government has got its own ideas of what needs to happen and so on. The education community stands apart from the business community. And so we have to do this, but we're not going to do it in Washington at the moment. That's hopeless right now. Someday we'll get back to a better dialogue in Washington. But in the meantime, we've got to do it at the local level. Businesses in our communities need to work with their education colleagues. They need to work with labor. They need to figure out how do we build the local workforce skills needed for the future. And so we're seeing some communities do this better than others as they rebuild from jobs lost overseas, and we need to have more examples of that happen at the local level.
All right. What I'm going to do right now is you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio, and we are talking with Sean Cutchin about the book Shaping the Future of the World, a Handbook for Action and a New Social Contract, which he co-authored with Lee Dyer. In reference to the new social contract, what are the low road and high road business strategies, and what is the reason behind both, and give us some examples if you would?
Sure. This is really a key point. And the key point is there's no iron law of economics that says there's only one way to compete. Firms make strategic decisions and choices about how they are going to compete. And we have companies on competing and doing very well financially for their shareholders and top executives on what we call the low road. So let me give you the classic example. It's Walmart. Walmart makes a lot of money. It's very financially successful, and it does it by keeping prices low for its customers. But that means it also keeps wages low, and it controls the labor force, and it treats labor like a commodity, like a cost to be controlled, rather than as an asset to invest and to develop and to help run the business. And so Walmart has very high turnover. It doesn't really treat its employees very well. It keeps unions out. It suppresses any efforts to gain a voice at work and organize a union. And it makes money for its owners and its shareholders. But on the other hand, there's a high road of competing, and that is organizations like Costco that compete with Walmart in retail. But they invest in their employees. They train them to be good at helping customers meet their needs in their stores. They train them to know more about how the business works and where and work together in teams so that they can solve problems for customers, or they can refer customers to a colleague who knows more about the product that the customer is asking about. And by doing that, they get higher levels of productivity. They hold on to their employees longer so that they don't have as high a turnover, and they can pay better wages. And some of their stores are unionized and some are not, but they don't make a big deal out of trying to keep unions out of the organization at all costs. So if we have more high road employers, we would have a better social contract. We would have firms that are profitable, like Costco. They're even doing better than Walmart on some dimensions. And we would have jobs that are meaningful jobs, that are good paying jobs, that can support families and communities.
What would you do? How would you deal, say, with Walmart to change their view? And how could that be done, or can it be done?
Well, I think it would be a long process of change for Walmart, but it's not impossible. And in fact, they're under strong pressure to change right now. You see that states are raising their minimum wage in some settings. You see campaigns by community and labor groups for raising the minimum wage, for raising the fight for 15, as it's called, for a $15 an hour starting wage. And that pressure has forced Walmart to increase its starting wage for its associates. And so we need to keep the pressure on these firms by saying you've got to meet certain labor standards. I believe that there are groups at Walmart right now trying to organize. There's something called Our Walmart, a group of employees that are communicating with each other and using all kinds of technology and social media and artificial intelligence tools to share information on their problems at Walmart and the opportunities for working together. So they need to embrace the workforce, and they need to stop trying to crush every form of employee voice and unionization, and embrace unions as a more potential ally in improving the workplace. We've got to make sure that we are using technology advantageously to support workers, to augment work, to give them the information they need to help solve customer problems. And then finally, we've got to re-educate business leaders, and we've got to start changing their compensation structures so that they have an incentive to support the workforce, not just to grease their own pockets with stock options and short-term profits. So we've got a lot of work to do, but I think we have a menu of things that if the citizens themselves start to raise these issues, we can start to make progress.
There's an issue here that keeps coming back to my mind, and that is what a credit card does, what those kinds of things as far as stock options and these and buying back things, is instant gratification. In other words, I get money now, and if I could get more later on, but I want it right now. How do we blend that out of the equation? Because this is seemingly what the low road companies do. They want money right now. And how do we stop that, or how do we change that? Is there a way?
There are a couple of things that can be done. There's no magic bullet.
Right.
But we've got to put more and more pressure on Wall Street to take the long run, a long-term view. And we can do part of that with tax policy. You know, big debates going on in Congress right now over lowering the corporate tax rate. Well, I'm not against lowering the corporate tax rate, but let's put some constraints on it so that we get reinvestment in our businesses and say, if we're going to lower your overall rate, then we want you to reinvest your profits. We want you to invest in more training, and we will give you a lower tax rate for investments in training and development of your workforce. We will give you a lower tax rate in our communities if you locate here and if you invest in working with our schools and help us to upgrade our infrastructure to improve our transportation systems and our broadband communications and make it available to more people in our rural areas. If we get business to do its part, then we can provide some trade-offs that they're looking for. But it all has to be in the interest of investing for the long run, not just cut the tax rate and let them give more dividends to their share owners or pay their top executives even more, or let them benefit more from stock options. That's the short-term disease that helped get us into this mess, and we've got to turn that around with tax policy, with rebuilding the strength of unions to challenge business to invest for the long run and to create incentives for business to educate and train and invest in their workforce. Walmart could get there with those kinds of changes, but it's going to take that combination, and it's going to take sticking with it for not just 6 months or a year or 2 years, but probably for a decade.
Well, there's an interesting thing. There's a public bank in North Dakota that basically says if we lend you money, millions of dollars, you've got to provide a permanent job at 100,000 as 100,000 comes in. In other words, we invest $100,000, you've got to bring on a permanent employee. That sounds like an idea, but I don't know how it would work, because they keep telling me that, or what I hear is they're trying to knock that public bank out. Wall Street does.
Well, Wall Street doesn't like that because it might be a competitor to Wall Street, and it's the kind of public investment institution that helped us to build our economy in the first place. You know, where did we get the Tennessee Valley Authority and all that infrastructure investment that put up dams in the southeastern part of the country to help that part both avoid environmental disasters, but also to build that region's economy. Well, those were government funds used through various kinds of bank financing, public-private partnerships. And we could do that with infrastructure all over the country. You know as well as I do, in Kansas City, as well as Boston, to Milwaukee, to rural Wisconsin, to rural Missouri, that there's all kinds of needs for infrastructure, for better communications and broadband technology, for better roads, for better sewer systems to take care of our water supply and our environment, wind farms, solar power. All of those investments will strengthen the economy. They'll have good economic returns for business, and they will improve wages and create new jobs. So we need to have those kinds of public-private partnership investments, and Wall Street better get on with it. Otherwise, there's going to be more and more of a revolt by Main Street against Wall Street.
Right. There is one thing I'd like you to discuss just a little bit about Saturn and General Motors and what happened there. They were successful and then went out of it.
Well, Saturn is a very sad story. It was a very positive story for a while. Saturn was a new division of General Motors that they said, let's take a clean sheet of paper to how we're going to run this organization, what kind of labor relations system we're going to have. Let's work in partnership with the United Automobile Workers Union, and let's figure out how we can engage the workforce in problem solving, in teamwork, and helping to build very high quality cars. And they came up with a very different kind of organization and partnership model that worked very well. It created the cars that got the highest satisfaction rating of any cars made in the United States for the first 4 or 5 years of their existence. And it was generating a profit for small cars that they couldn't generate under the old General Motors system. But then it was too radical. The company said, we're giving too much control to the workforce. We're not sure we want the union to be that much of a partner. And the top leaders of the auto workers union likewise said, oh, that's too much cooperation. It's not the union tradition, and it's not the way we do things. So the top leadership also walked away from the partnership, and eventually they stopped investing in it, and eventually the company went downhill. And then when General Motors was thrown into bankruptcy, finally they said, well, we can't keep Saturn going. And so it's a very sad statement.
But it's
that here we had a model that really worked well,
right?
But it was way out ahead of what top-level managers and executives and at GM and top-level union leaders at the UAW could tolerate.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I understand that would be the model, just hopefully that we can get people to really look at it that way. And we're going to wrap this up, and I really appreciate your interview, and thanks a lot, Tom.
Thank you, Lon.
You take care now.
Did you know underwriting KKFI's programming spreads the word about your organization or event and supports KKFI at the same time? Learn more at kkfi.org/underwriting.
Hello, this is Joseph Jackson reminding you that Medicare open enrollment period ends December 7th. Now is the time to compare programs for 2018 to ensure that you have coverage that is right for you. For more information, go to medicare.gov to find out about different plans that may be available. If you don't change your plan, you will be locked into your current plan until the next cycle opens October of 2018. So go to medicare.gov to get more information to ensure that you have the right Medicare plan for you. Thank you.
Ghost suppers and Native American foodways from the Great Lakes to Virginia on the Thursday night special at 7.
Thank you. there is nothing to divide. My kin don't need to fuss and moan. Moss does not cling to a rolling stone. My body, if I could choose, I would to ashes it reduce. Then let the merry breezes blow my dust to where some flower grows. Perhaps some fading flower then would spring to life and bloom again. This is my last and final will. Good luck to all of you.
Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Jacob White. Tonight we will be discussing how the legal system in Missouri works and doesn't work for people of color, the working poor, and the unemployed. This is a situation that has garnered increasing attention over the last few years, highlighted by around this time last year, when former Missouri Governor Jay Nixon was called on to serve as a public defender. Let's listen to a clip from March of this year discussing the plight of public defenders in Missouri.
Some advocates say Missouri's doing wrong by its citizens by underfunding the agency that supports that right, the state public defender system. KOMU8's Nora Ferris is here in the studio to explain how the lack of funding causes disorder in Missouri's court system.
This week, the House Budget Committee earmarked an additional $6.8 million in funding for the state's public defender system. But state administrators say that's still not enough to do justice. Due to budget and staffing constraints, Missouri's public defenders have an average caseload of 100 to 200 cases at any given time. The director of the state's public defender system says overburdened attorneys are an injustice to their clients. They simply can't do all that's required for that many cases.
Investigating the case, meet with witnesses, do the research, motion practice, courtroom appearances. The thought of public defenders having 150 cases, it's absolutely impossible.
Missouri currently ranks 49th out of 50 states for per capita spending on public defenders. Barrett says underfunding the public defender system can lead to overspending by the state. He says Missouri spends millions each year to imprison nonviolent offenders at the expense of prosecuting and punishing violent criminals. Reporting in the studio, Nora Ferris, KOMU 8 News.
This is not a problem that is limited to Missouri, and surprisingly, this is a problem that legislators from both sides of the aisle are slowly coming around on. The Marshall Project, run by former New York Times executive editor Bill Keller, published a fascinating article about how some conservative lawmakers are advocating for increased funding for public defense in an article from September by Alicia Santo. Here's a clip from that article. The article is called How Conservatives Learn to Love Free Lawyers for the Poor, and can be found on the Marshall Project's website.
Framework that allows conservatives to be at the table, too. I'm not trying to excuse racism. I don't deny racial disparities. Those are facts, Carol says. But people don't believe I'm racist. So why do you have to force them to go to confession just to start working on this? All it does is drive a wedge and make this impossible. David Carroll remembers when he first understood the price poor people paid for not being able to afford a good lawyer. In the mid-90s, he had just graduated from college and was in Tennessee working for a group that studied legal systems for the poor. While sitting in a Memphis courtroom, he watched a public defender standing on a chair to offer the same plea deal to a room full of mostly black defendants. This, he knew, was not what the Supreme Court had intended in 1963 when it ruled in Gideon v. Wainwright that defendants facing felony charges had a right to a lawyer even if they couldn't afford one. Later, the right was extended to anyone facing jail time. But in practice, that promise is broken time and again. Without direction from the court, states have developed a hodgepodge of systems, from state and county-run public defender offices to contracts with private attorneys and nonprofits. About 80% of criminal defendants in the U.S. are eligible for court-appointed attorneys, including public defenders. But their fates are often determined by luck and geography. In Delaware, defendants have been pressured to meet with prosecutors before their eligibility for a public defender had been determined. In Mississippi, they've been jailed on bail they can't afford before consulting a lawyer. In Missouri, defense attorneys have appeared in court completely unprepared. In California, some attorneys spend little more than an hour on each case. And in Washington State, lawyers for children have encouraged their clients to plead guilty even when additional motions were available.
On September 27, 2017, Michael Barrett, who heads up Missouri's public defender system, published an op-ed in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. This was the conclusion to his op-ed. It is increasingly hard to ignore the disparate choices being made in policing, charging, pretrial status, and sentencing that seem to have poverty and race as common denominators. Indeed, the protests taking place in St. Louis and in stadiums across the country highlight a justice system that does not comport with the promise of America because it is inextricably linked to whether the suspect is someone society values. If you are a police officer suspected of a crime, a judge, a politician, the child of either, or just someone who looks the part, our justice system lives up to its reputation as the best in the world. But if you're poor, a person of color, or both, it is an entirely distinct experience, one far more horrifying. And that's the criticism. This isn't a call for less justice for Officer Stokely or Wilson. It's a call for equality under the law. Until that changes, we will see unrest and disunity, and it will be deserved. Earlier, we heard a clip of Michael Barrett discussing the enormous caseloads that public defenders in Missouri take on. But not every case results in a nonviolent offender languishing in jail or pleading guilty and taking a prison sentence in a case that could have been better fought if the resources to do so were there. The Missouri Public Defender's Office, like many other public defenders across the country, also take on the most serious cases in the justice system, offenses for which the death penalty is on the table. In the past month, Missouri has been the setting for two high-profile death penalty cases being argued by public defenders. A quick content warning to anyone who might be uncomfortable, both of these cases do have some disturbing details. So Marvin Rice faces the death penalty and is represented by Missouri Public Defender Charles Hoskins. Craig Wood faces the death penalty and is represented by Missouri Public Defender Patrick Berrigan. Joining me from Philadelphia to discuss these issues is Robert Dunham. Robert became the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center in March 2015. A nationally recognized expert on the death penalty, Mr. Dunham has 25 years of experience as a capital litigator and teacher of death penalty law, including arguing in the U.S. Supreme Court. Robert, are you there? Thanks for joining us.
I am. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the specifics of these cases, I want to talk about the resources that go into a death penalty case. So in 1997, in his book about Powell versus Alabama, Professor Gerald Horn wrote that the average cost for a defense lawyer in a death penalty case was about $50,000, but public funding for defense in death penalty cases is often much lower. From your experience, is that still the case? Is there still that disparity?
Well, there isn't a single cost for the death penalty in in a given case, that the costs are very different from state to state. But generally speaking, it costs more when you have court-appointed lawyers than it does when you have an institutional defender, because an institutional defender has a lot of expertise, and you've got a staff investigator, you've got people who are trained in particular areas. So what we found is that it costs less when you are defending capital cases if you have an institutional capital defender. Another thing that's very interesting about that is the outcomes are extremely different. So in states that have a properly funded system of indigent defense and a properly funded capital defense system, you have many fewer death sentences. You have a lot more arbitrary death sentences and death sentences that tend to get overturned because of ineffective assistance of counsel when you have court-appointed lawyers who don't have institutional expertise.
So let's go a little bit into the cases. If we could start by talking about the Craig Wood case that is it's in Springfield, Missouri. Is that right?
I guess I don't know. I'm not familiar with the facts of the cases. I can tell you about the legal issue with non-unanimous juries.
Yeah. So just to fill in our audience, it's been in the papers recently, but there's a non-unanimous jury facing with the death penalty case, and so we're having Robert on to comment and tell us a little bit more about what that means.
Generally speaking, in most states in the United States, the way the court determines whether somebody gets sentenced to death works like this. You have a first stage of trial, and the defendant gets charged with some form of murder. To be eligible for the death penalty in the United States, you have to have been convicted of murder. That's not enough to get the death penalty. To be eligible for the death penalty in addition to murder, you have to have something called an aggravating circumstance, some fact that makes the offense worse than a normal murder. And then the defense has an opportunity to present what are called mitigating circumstances, reasons for life. That goes to a jury in almost all states, and the jury is asked to find whether there is an aggravating circumstance that could justify imposing the death penalty. They have to unanimously agree about that, and they have to consider reasons to spare the defendant's life, and they weigh the aggravating and mitigating circumstances. In almost every state, unless they unanimously agree that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating circumstances, that is, reasons for death are stronger than reasons for life, if they don't unanimously agree to that, then the defendant gets a life sentence. There are a couple of states that are different, and they are Alabama, which permits, which actually has the judge decide after the jury makes a recommendation. And if there is a recommendation of 10 jurors for death, then the judge will decide whether to impose a life sentence or a death sentence, but gets to decide whatever he wants. In Missouri and in Indiana, if the jury is unanimous for life or unanimous for death, that's the sentence. But if the jury does not reach a complete agreement, then the judge gets to decide. And the question from a legal perspective is that constitutional? The United States Supreme Court has said juries must find all facts that make a defendant eligible for the death penalty, to make a defendant all facts that are necessary before a death sentence can be imposed. And if the judge is making his own decision, if the judge is considering the aggravating circumstances, considering the mitigating circumstances, if he isn't finding the facts that make the defendant eligible for the death penalty, if he isn't finding the facts that are necessary for a death penalty to be imposed, then what's he doing? If he is finding those facts, and it's based on his independent fact-finding, then the process would seem to violate a 2016 opinion by the United States Supreme Court called Hearst versus Florida. So that's one of the issues in Missouri.
And so there's also the case of Marvin Rice, and that's a similar situation where 11 of the 12 jurors voted to spare his life, but then Judge Kelly Wayne Parker imposed the death penalty. So could you sort of just reiterate how Missouri's
judicial system is sort of coming into conflict with the Supreme Court on this. I think it might not be totally clear for our audience.
Well, they're actually the Rice case presents two very interesting issues. First, the very basic principle that's followed by almost all states is if you have a jury deciding a verdict, the verdict has to be unanimous. And in a death penalty case, if the jury does not unanimously agree that a death penalty should be imposed, the verdict is life. Only Alabama says a non-unanimous jury recommendation for death can result in death sentence if a judge says so. And two other states, Missouri and Indiana, say if the jury doesn't agree, we're turning it over to the judge and the judge independently decides. If the judge is independently deciding, then that's violating the defendant's right to a jury determination of life or death. And the United States Supreme Court in 2016 says defendants have that right. So that's the issue for both of the cases. With Rice, there's another very important issue, which is the question of can a judge override a jury's recommendation for life? There is no state in the United States that expressly says if you have more jurors voting for life than vote for death, the judge is allowed to impose a death penalty. A couple states used to do that. They all repealed it. Missouri effectively does that. It doesn't call it judicial override of a life verdict. It says there's a hung jury, and then the judge gets to decide. But if the jury was not unanimous, was hung because there were more jurors who wanted life than who wanted death, then what you're really seeing is the judge overriding the will of the public, the judge overriding the jury's recommendation for life. Because almost nobody does that, because almost everybody else rejects it, there's a doctrine in the United States Supreme Court called the Evolving Standards of Decency. And if there's a national consensus against the practice and it offends the Evolving Standards of Decency, it's unconstitutional. So you can expect to see in Missouri cases where more jurors voted for life than voted for death, and a judge then goes ahead and imposes the death penalty, you can expect to see that challenged under the Eighth Amendment as offending the Evolving Standards of Decency.
So is that going to play out? Can these cases go to the Supreme Court? How will this play out over the next couple of years?
Well, the Rice case is going to be appealed, and his lawyers will raise a number of issues. One of them I would expect would be a challenge to the way in which Missouri reached its decision on imposing the death penalty. So the case will be appealed first to the Missouri Supreme Court. The Missouri Supreme Court already, in a case called State versus Shockley, has upheld this particular method of sentencing defendants to death. But Shockley was decided in 2013, 3 years before the United States decision in Hearst versus Florida. So you can expect the defense to argue that given what the Supreme Court said in Hearst, Missouri's practice is not proper. If the Missouri Supreme Court says, well, no, we're going to let this go, we're going to say it's still okay, then the defendant has a right to ask the United States Supreme Court to review the case. The court doesn't have to take the appeal. It doesn't have to hear the appeal. But because of the particular nature of this issue and the fact that Missouri would be in conflict with the laws, with the Constitution as interpreted in other states, it has a number of factors that would make it more likely for the court to sit back and take notice and say, we're going to review this issue.
We've been speaking with Robert Dunham. Robert, thank you so much for telling us about this very unusual legal situation happening in Missouri. We've only got about a minute left, but you're joining us from Philadelphia. I was hoping maybe you could share a little bit of your feelings about Larry Krasner being named the new DA, being elected as the DA of Philadelphia, and if that's going to have some implications for the justice system in the United States.
Well, it's going to have very significant implications for the justice system in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is the third largest death row of any county in the United States. And one of the things that Mr. Krasner said when he ran was that he was not going to impose the death penalty. He's not going to seek the death penalty at all. Mr. Krasner is probably the most progressive district attorney candidate who has been elected in the United States. And he's indicated that he's going to try to address issues of cash bail, mass incarceration, and so forth. I think it's part of a pattern that we're seeing across the United States with more and more reform district attorneys being elected. But the question is going to be, how successful is he going to be in bringing about these reforms?
Robert Dunham is the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Robert joined us from Philadelphia today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams from the law offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today, I wanted to talk a little bit about a big employment case that was heard in the Supreme Court on October 3rd, 2017. This is the case of Epic Systems Corp. versus Lewis. This is a big case that is going to be heard this term that will be decided later on before the end of the term. And the question in this case related to employees and employers is whether an agreement that requires an employer and an employee to resolve any employment-related dispute through individual arbitration and to waive class action and collective procedures is enforceable under the Federal Arbitration Act, notwithstanding any provisions that are contained in the National Labor Relations Act. The argument in this case centers on essentially two federal laws that are extremely old. One of them is the Federal Arbitration Act, and one of them is the National Labor Relations Act. The Federal Arbitration Act provides that arbitration agreements shall be valid, irrevocable, and enforceable, and the National Labor Relations Act provides that employees have the right to concerted activities for mutual aid or protection. Those two arguments, or those two laws, seem to conflict because on one hand you have an arbitration clause that somewhere around 25 million employees and employers are covered by already right now that says they're irrevocable and enforceable, but then you also have the National Labor Relations Act that says that people have the right to collective action, which would seem to include the right to, like, say, class action lawsuits. In the argument, the lawyers for the employers really pressed upon the idea that that these arbitration agreements should be enforced unless they're clearly contrary to a command from Congress, and they're arguing that that's not present here. However, the justices on the more liberal side of the court, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in particular, suggested that there was an irreconcilable conflict between the Federal Arbitration Act and the National Labor Relations Act. One says that you have to only do, or that they should enforce arbitration agreements which only allow for individual actions, and the other one in the NLRA that says that employees have the right to work together in some kind of collective action. Justice Bader Ginsburg pointed out that the collective action phrases in the NLRA is the driving force which corrects the imbalance in between employers and employees. And by protecting the arbitration agreement, that runs counter to the NLRA. The government continued to argue that the NLRA was only intended to protect collective action in the workplace and to allow employees to get to a forum in which to raise their grievances with the employer, but that once employees got to that forum, then the employer was allowed to present any defense possible. Justice Kagan seemed skeptical about that and argued that not only does the NLRA not say that, but the Supreme Court has also held cases. On the other hand, some of the more conservative-minded justices seemed very, very hesitant to invalidate agreements that more than 25 million employees and employers are covered by right here. They expressed somewhat hesitant views on whether or not that would be a good idea to set for precedent. This case is, like I said, was argued in the first day of the new session in this October that started October 3rd, 2017. There is not a decision yet, and because this is one of the bigger cases, I would likely bet that there's not going to be a decision until sometime next year. But this is one that I'm going to be watching carefully, and I will report on again once we have a decision to let everybody know what the ruling was. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. This is all the time we have today. Thank you for listening and be safe.
And I'm Judy Ansel with this week's calendar. This Saturday, it's the third Saturday Democratic Breakfast with all of the Democratic candidates for the Kansas 3rd Congressional District. That's November 18th, 8 a.m. for breakfast, 9 a.m. for the speakers, and it's at Las Islas Marias, 7516 State Avenue. If you are going to come for breakfast, you should RSVP to scottmackey08@yahoo.com. Friendsgiving for a Clean Dream Act, November 18th, also Saturday from 5 to 8 p.m. at Village Presbyterian Church, 6641 Mission Road, Prairie Village, Kansas. There'll be a showing of Greg Palast's film, The Best Documentary Money Can, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, with discussant from the Industrial Workers of the World. Sunday, November 19th at 2 p.m., UMKC's Hague Hall, room 301. Hague Hall is on the northwest corner of 52nd and Rock Hill, and that's an event of the Community of Reason. Our Part in White Supremacy, a discussion, Saturday, November 19th. I guess our means whites. I'm not sure. Anyway, Saturday, November 19th, noon, Shawnee Mission, Unitarian Universalist Church, 9400 Flum Road, Lenexa. And Stand Up KC invites you to shut down Trump Jr. and Kobach's fundraiser for hate. Tuesday, November 28th, mobilize at 4:30 p.m. at Shannon Valley Park, 11100 Grant Drive in Overland Park. Then march at 5 p.m. to the Doubletree, where the fundraiser is, at 10100 College Boulevard, Overland Park. That's our calendar. You can find it on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, as well as our upcoming shows and our archive of old shows. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to do a repeat of a show. We just won the first prize in the International Labor Communications Association's Film and Radio Broadcast Awards. And the show is called, it's about Harley and its unions. And so tune in to that after you've eaten your turkey. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.